Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of the Kevin Rose Show. Not sure if you can hear it on the mic or not, but it's raining outside here in Portland, Oregon. It is fall, leaves are on the ground. It's beautiful. So just enjoying that today. One housekeeping thing before we get started. Multitask, even though I don't recommend multitasking, head on over and multitask out of your podcasting app real quick. And if you wouldn't mind, follow me up on Instagram at Kevin Rose. We are approaching the winter months, and on Instagram, I always like to document my Wim Hof cold exposure. I always do the Wim Hof method during the winter months. I have a pool in the backyard, and it's freezing, and then I use that to jump into it and expose myself to the cold, and there's a lot of amazing benefits that come from that in terms of my energy levels and my focus. A bunch of great compounds get released in the brain. And if you're curious about more of the science behind that, rather than me just rambling here, head on over to foundmyfitness.com. And Rhonda Patrick has a great paper on cold exposure, or you can just Google Rhonda Patrick cold exposure PDF. And she references all of the different scientific literature and published studies around the benefits of cold exposure. So definitely check that out. Also check out her paper on sauna usage. So sauna is also another really helpful thing in terms of preventing cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. A lot of really interesting work and studies that are coming out there as well. Anyway, so today's show is David Sinclair. And David Sinclair is a professor in the Department of Genetics and co-director of the Center for the Biology of Aging at Harvard Medical School. He is brilliant, definitely. And I think about the people I've had on the podcast in the past, like the, you know, Elon Musk's of the world and Ev Williams and a bunch of great folks. He's definitely in the top percent of genius. Really excited to have him on. He is also the co-founder of 7 biotechnology companies and is on the board of several others. He's the co-founder and co-editor of the journal Aging. His work has been featured in 5 books, 2 documentaries, 60 Minutes interviews, and numerous podcasts. And he's also the inventor on 35 patents and has received more than 25 awards and honors. Like, David has done it all. We'll get into this in the podcast, but he's also played a huge role in the discovery of resveratrol, which I'm sure you may remember. It is the compound in red wine that they were linking to longevity. And he is actually still taking resveratrol. And we talk about some of the controversy around that and why he still takes it. David has a new book out. It's called Lifespan, The Revolutionary Science of Why We Age and Why We Don't Have to. I love this book. He sent me a copy. I went straight into it. And I think it's kind of broken into 2 parts. One is some of the things that we can do now to really slow down aging. So think, you know, saunas, cold exposure, intermittent fasting, a whole slew of different compounds like metformin and resveratrol and something called NMN, which will actually boost your NAD levels, which means you can have more energy. And so we dig into all of this and really flesh out what he's up to, what he's doing. But the second part of his book is really talking about why he believes that we've discovered the source of aging and how aging's days are really numbered. And right now in his lab, they are reversing and restoring youth in mice. It's nuts. It sounds like sci-fi, but I feel like after talking to David, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we're going to be doing all kinds of crazy things in terms of regenerating youth in various organs throughout the body. And this is no longer sci-fi. This is stuff that's happening in the lab right now. That's why this book is so important to get this information out there. All right, so let's get into it. This is David Sinclair from Harvard Medical School.
One of the things I wanted to start off with that I have always been fascinated with your career and looking back on the things that you've done, discovering resveratrol, I think, was obviously a huge deal. Would you mind starting there and just giving me kind of the backstory? How did you figure this out, and how did your lab come up with it?
It's an interesting story. We were working on some genes that we had discovered could control aging in yeast cells, and this is mid 1990s. And I moved to Harvard. I was only 29, didn't really know what I was doing, but what I decided to do, which was smart in retrospect, was to see if we could find any molecule that would change the activity of this genetic pathway. Specifically, would bind to that enzyme, which we called SIRT1, and make it work better. And the rationale was that I wanted to have something that I could feed to mice or eventually feed to ourselves instead of genetically modifying them, which was up until that point the only way we could extend lifespan. And what happened was I was very lucky. I've been very lucky in my life. I was collaborating with a fellow called Dr. Conrad Howitz, and he was at a local company, a small company in Philly, actually. And he called up and he said, "Hey, we're really excited about these sirtuin genes that you guys work on. Would you like to work with us?" And I said, "Absolutely." He said, "You know what? I've got this assay for a test tube that we think works to tell you how well this is working." And so we tested it. It looked great. And we said, "Well, let's try to find some chemicals that would either up or downregulate the enzyme." And I don't know if anyone's familiar really with pharmaceutical development, but finding inhibitors, things that knock down the activity, are really easy. That's pretty much how all the drugs on the market work. But finding an activator, which is what I was really hoping for, there's never been an example of that in the whole pharmaceutical industry. So to find it, you'd have to be the luckiest person on earth. And what happened was Conrad called me up one day and said, "Are you sitting down, David?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sitting down." He goes, "I think we found an activator." I said, "Come on, it's not possible." And he said, "And guess what? It comes from red wine." And I thought, "Oh, great. I can just see the future of my life. Right. It's all going to be about red wine." But to cut a long story short, we tested it in our lab. Conrad was right. It really seemed to be an activator. It wasn't just a fake result or an artifact. And we started feeding this to yeast cells. And in those days, I used to have to sit at the microscope myself. And it used to take about 10 days of sitting pretty much 18 hours a day in front of a microscope, which was horrific. So what I did was we just had a newborn baby, and I took a microscope, an incubator. I built a lab in my dining room, and so I could be at home helping my wife, Sandra, while I was doing this experiment. And the plates were labeled A, B, C, D, so I didn't know which ones had the resveratrol and which ones didn't. There was a plate C. Plate C, I remember, was living about 60% longer than normal. And I called up my student and said, "You have to tell me, is plate C the one with the resveratrol in it?" And he said, "Yep." And that was where it began. And I called up my wife. She was walking with our baby. And I said, "Something really important has just happened. I can't wait to tell you about it."
Wow, that's crazy. What a very cool, I didn't know you were at home when you did that. That's talk about multitasking, juggling a newborn and doing a study. I'm curious, where this netted out in terms of when you took it in from an animal model into humans, where do we stand today with resveratrol? I know you still take it. What's the current status of that?
Right. Well, what the outside world, outside my lab, knows is much less than what we know in my lab. And the media has muddied the waters because they swing from, "Wow, this is remarkable. We're all going to live forever," to, "Oh, this is all wrong." And neither of those is true. So what's true is that we worked for many years to show that mice that were on a high-fat diet or were eating resveratrol every other day had a significant lifespan extension because they were healthier. Those mice that were on resveratrol and a Western diet, even though they were obese, they lived just as long as a healthy one. And what was important for scientists at the time was there was never a molecule, except this one, for the first time, could mimic the benefits of a lean diet or calorie restriction without actually having to restrict calories. So we would call that a calorie restriction mimetic. And it was very safe. And this was, now we take it for granted that you can do this. But in those days, no one knew that that was possible. And what about the human story? So we started a company out of the lab called Sirtris, and they worked to make 14,000 different molecules that were synthetic and more potent than resveratrol, because resveratrol is not a very good molecule for a drug. It's more like brick dust. It doesn't dissolve very well, and I still have to put it in yogurt to get it to absorb. And we've known that. And people who do clinical trials with resveratrol often have no idea how to deliver it. They give it in a capsule with no food, and that's not going to get absorbed. On the other hand, there have been plenty of clinical trials where people have dosed resveratrol with food. And there you do see some positive benefits. The latest one was just a few months ago. showing that resveratrol lowers blood sugar levels, just as we showed in mice. So the media doesn't report those little findings, but the resveratrol field has continued to be positive. But what about these drugs? Well, what happened was they went into humans and they were safe, the one they tested. And even though it was largely like brick dust as well, it worked to prevent and treat a disease called psoriasis, which is inflammation of the skin. I'm sure anyone who's had a family member or themselves having psoriasis, they know it's a devastating disease, or it can be. And there are 40 patients in that study. It was run by Jim Kruger, a professor in New York at NYU. And it was a big success, actually, and it's now published. What happened then was that because it was a brick dust molecule, it didn't get absorbed very well in about half the people. And so GlaxoSmithKline, who bought the company and the invention, put a big team on this. They were spending, I'm told, about $20 million a year. They made another number of molecules that were soluble. And then they just lost the will. And what wasn't helpful was that scientists at Pfizer and at Amgen came out with publications in 2010 saying that our hypothesis was completely wrong. And that really put a real break on the entire field, which we still feel today.
Is that partially just because they were delivering it wrong in terms of, I would imagine one, it's you know, obviously has to be delivered correctly. It sounds like it needs fat to go along with it. And then are just the things that the outcomes that you measure, are they not apparent enough in a small short-term trial? Is it something where you would see, you know, some of the longevity benefits, but it's going to take decades to eventually get to those results?
Yeah, good point. So what you're reminding me to say is we gave these drugs that were in development to mice, even on just a normal diet. They didn't have to be fat, and they lived longer. Now, that's a remarkable finding, actually. The credit goes to Rafael DiCarbo down at NIH. And that, again, was a milestone in the aging field that is very rarely recognized as such. But it was the first time that molecules were designed to slow aging based on knowledge of aging and longevity genes, and they worked. And so those studies, though, I think what the criticism was, actually I know the criticism of Pfizer and Amgen was, that assay that Conrad Howitz developed in the test tube, they thought was not representative of what really happens in the cell. And so there's a big debate that resveratrol really doesn't work through the sirtuin enzyme. And that basically if that was true, that would invalidate our patent. And you can argue what the motivations were. It could have been nefarious, could have been just scientists being scientists. But it really was a problem when people said that these drugs that were being developed by Glaxo were based on a false assay and the whole thing was a mistake. So that was devastating. I was dragged through the mud in the media. This Nature magazine put a photo and said that, you know, this was science that was not reliable. And basically, I was written off as a scientist. When that happens to you and you spent your whole life trying to improve people's lives, it turns out it's pretty hard to get out of bed the next day. And I remember for about a week, I was really mad with humanity, the way I was treated. But fortunately, I've got a large amount of grit and determination and one goal in life. So I could do nothing else but get out of bed and come into work and start doing more experiments to see if they were right or we were right. And so we published a paper 3 years later that said and proved without a doubt that we were right. And we even have new experiments that we haven't published, but I'll tell you about, where we've engineered a mouse that is missing one amino acid in the SIRT1 enzyme that blocks the ability of resveratrol to turn it on. And that mouse, lacking that one amino acid in one protein, no longer lives a greater lifespan when you feed it resveratrol. And it's night and day. It's a perfect proof that we were right in a living animal. And so, you know, it's now been, what, almost 10 years since that happened. And still I meet plenty of people who say, oh, yeah, that was all just a bunch of BS. And that's pretty painful, right? Because we know we're right. We've proven we were right. Last 7 years we've known we're right. But the news hasn't gotten out to the general public. That said, you know, now I'm able to tell my story more and more, and resveratrol seems to work well in people in clinical trials. So I think it's slowly happening, but these drugs that could have been really helpful to patients may never reach patients because of this scientific debate.
That's crazy. I had no idea about the backstory. The only thing I had ever heard recently was that it does work. It just needs to be taken with fat. And that was part of the reason why you weren't seeing positive results in the past.
Well, yeah, it's right. It's just that we need drug-like molecules, and those sit in the fridges and freezers of GlaxoSmithKline currently.
Wow. And there's no way that they would sell those outright, or is it something where it's just it's shelved forever?
Well, nothing's forever, but the patent life is running out, and I needed about $20 million to revive those clinical trials. And I don't have a spare $20 million anymore. I've spent it all on other companies. But so that's where we sit. It's unfortunate, but I'm never going to give up. It's one of the reasons that I'd like to live a bit longer so that I have a chance to complete what I've started.
You know, your book, Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To, I'd love to talk about the why we age component, because I think that, in hearing about, in reading through your book, we know a lot more than we did just a few years ago. Can you give us the current kind of state of affairs on why do we believe we age now?
Well, what I believe is different than what most scientists would tell you. And so what readers get in the book is a new version of why we age that's come out of 20 years of my research into yeast aging. And I actually believe now from a lot of work that we age for the same reason that yeast cells age. And that is that aging is simply a loss of information. Okay, that's all it is. And so you might say, well, David, what do you mean by that? And actually, there are two types of information in the body. One is genetic. That's our digital information. It's very robust, lasts for at least 80 years, probably longer, actually 10,000 years if you're a mummy. But there's another type of information that's much more fragile, because this type of information is encoded in mostly analog format. And we know how bad analog information is. That's why we don't use it anymore, typically.
Why did this information start off in analog? Why wasn't it was it digital to begin with, or do you not know?
It probably wasn't digital to begin with, because this analog information works much better in analog, because it has to adjust within seconds of a change in the environment, whereas we know the genome doesn't change within a lifetime. And so this is similar to a DVD and a DVD player. The DVD has the information, it doesn't change, but the player can read a different song whenever you tell it to. And so the analog information is like that, the player. But the problem is the player, which is the analog of the what we call the epigenome, the systems in the cell that read the right genes at the right time, that player becomes malfunctional over time. It's almost as if we get scratches on the DVD so that the player cannot read the right songs, and it starts to skip and the music starts to sound like crap. And the same is true, I believe, of aging. Our cells, even though they have largely intact information at the genetic level, even when we're old, the cells just fail to read that information correctly, so that cells that are supposed to be nerves start to lose their identity and behave more like a skin cell, and skin cells start to behave more like a liver cell. And essentially you become a bland mess of cells that don't know their true function. And that, I believe, is what we call aging.
Is it because they're copying bad information? You know, when you make a recording of a tape or, you know, anything like a record, it just, the copy is never going to be as good as the original. And that just continues forward. Is that essentially what's happening as they're replicating, they're losing data?
That's part of it. But actually, the information theory of aging, as I call it, it doesn't rely on cells to divide. And that's what's beautiful about it, because it explains why you can get aging in the brain, in nerve cells that don't divide your whole lifetime. Most of the nerves in the brain don't divide, but you do age, right? And so the idea is that it's not so much about the copying of the epigenome, these structures that regulate the genes. And actually, physically, what the epigenome is, it's loops of DNA that expose genes and bundles of DNA, very tight bundles like a hose reel on a driveway, that stop genes from being accessed. And that pattern of loops and bundles is different in every cell type. But over time, that pattern gets lost. And one of the main drivers of that, what we call epigenetic noise, is DNA damage, in particular, a broken chromosome, a broken strand of DNA, which cells have to react very vigorously to repair, because if you have a broken chromosome, you're going to die or you're going to turn into a tumor cell. Either way, it's bad news. And so what the cell does is it unwraps a lot of those loops and bundles in an effort to quickly repair the chromosome, but then it has to go back and repackage the DNA the way it was, you know, 5 minutes beforehand. And what we found is it doesn't do a perfect job. So over time, and our cells are getting broken chromosomes at least one or two times a day, and trillions in our body every day. Over time, it's like unwrapping a present and putting it back together. You can re-gift maybe once or twice, but if you do it, you know, 500 times, you're going to have a big mess. And that's what we think causes the genes to be read differently over time.
And the big discovery that you've made, when was it that you discovered there is a kind of master copy for this, essentially a clean version of this that can be reused?
Yeah, we didn't know that there was a backup copy of this information until a year ago. And that was a eureka moment, greater than I expected in my whole career. What I did know, though, was when we first worked on yeast cells back in 1997, I actually had a frenzied night where I woke up in the middle of the night and realized that this is probably the cause of aging, that DNA instability causes the cell to read the genes incorrectly. And so I wrote down the information theory of aging in a notebook over a matter of 3 hours, middle of the night, in my kitchen. And I have that book still in my my drawer here. And that moment, I really have just been testing that theory ever since. But I didn't know even in those days that it would be that easy to reset the cell and access the backup hard drive of that analog information. But we've shown, at least in some parts of a mouse's body, and in this case we use the eye, we can reset the eye and recover vision by restoring the ability of the cell to read the right genes at the right time the way the eye did when it was young.
That's amazing. And the thing that I can't figure out is that, you know, being on the computer science thing of side of things and being a technologist, when I think of a backup copy, I know where the backup is. Like, you know, you go out, you fetch it, you restore the data and everything is fine. You don't really know where the backup copy is. You're able to fetch it and restore the data. But is that correct? Like, you're not sure where the backup is coming from?
That's right. It's a fascinating time.
That's so crazy to me.
Right. Well, you know, there's a Nobel Prize up for grabs if someone wants to try and find it. But so speaking of computer science, one of my heroes is Claude Shannon, who in the 1940s basically wrote down the equations that led to the internet and the world we live in today. And he was the one that proposed you need a backup copy. But he also said that you need to be able to access that, what he called the observer, and tell it, hey, we need the rest of the backup copy. We don't know who the observer is in cells. We do know somewhat how to access the backup copy, tell the observer we have a problem. And so another analogy, which I really like, Kevin, is the clock on the wall. Most scientists know there's a clock. You can take a blood sample. I could take your blood right now and tell you how old you are biologically very accurately and when you're probably going to die. But nobody except us at this moment had thought that if you move the hands of the clock backwards, that time actually would go backwards. And that's what we've shown, actually. We can reset the clock and we get function back. We get youth back. And then we also know that a little bit about what's behind the clock. We've pulled out a couple of the cogs in the clock, some of those dials. And now the clock doesn't work anymore. We don't restore vision when we do this gene therapy in the eye. So we have a lot more to know. We need to figure out actually where the memory of what time it is in the clock. We don't know. Biologically, it might be stored on the DNA. It might be on a protein. We don't know. But actually, we've gone from one person in my lab working on this project to about 15 in my lab working on this problem because it's that important and that interesting.
How small can you find data? I mean, are we talking that some of this might exist at the kind of subatomic level, or do you even go that deep down? Or is this like you're expecting just to find it in plain sight, just like kind of, but you didn't see it before? Like,
right.
How do you even begin to search for something like this?
oh, it's not that hard. There are a lot of candidates that we're what we call screening, where geneticists, we knock out genes and see if things still work. It's really pretty easy. We're just taking pieces of the clock apart and seeing what happens one by one. And if you're really brave, you can take each piece out one at a time. And there's only 25,000 total pieces to the human cell. So it's not that hard. We can do that. But if it's subatomic, it's going to be harder. But I don't think so. We biochemists and geneticists work still in Newtonian physics and chemistry. It's not that hard. It can be pretty small, though. It can be one atom difference that can change how information is read. The clock that we currently read that would tell me your age is called DNA methylation. And you know how DNA has four bases, C, T, A, G. These methyl chemicals bind to the C letter, and that's only comprised of one carbon and three hydrogens. So we're talking about a very small mass here, but I hope it's not below the mass of an atom, or we're going to be struggling here. But it will require some physics, I'm sure of it. There are things like what's called phase transitions, where molecules behave differently depending on how they're organized and what they're bumping into. But we're right on the verge of the nano world and subatomic. But, you know, it's not that hard. We work on that every day. It doesn't seem weird to us.
And in the composition of your team that's working on these types of things, I would imagine it's changed over the years from just a pure scientist to, I'm sure you're using, you know, machine learning and AI type people working on this as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. Gone are the days where you could just grow things on a petri dish. Most of the people in my lab work with terabytes of data, petabytes sometimes. We don't analyze one gene at a time. We analyze 25,000, and we also do it, you know, with thousands of samples. It's expensive, but it's coming down in price. But yeah, we don't do things one at a time anymore. And most of the people in my lab are now playing catch up on trying to figure out how to analyze this data, because we're inundated with it every day. And we're just trying to figure out how do you, for instance, we can now measure those loops and those bundles with great accuracy, not just in a piece of muscle or a brain sample, but within a million different cells, each one having a different signature across the entire genome with gigabytes of data. So it's a massive, massive data problem, and you need machine learning just to even figure out what the clock is, let alone start to analyze the variation.
Wow, that's crazy. You mentioned reversing and restoring eyesight, kind of reversing the clock and restoring eyesight. I take it that's just been done in mice so far. When are we going to see this actually happening in humans? And then how does that transition and translate down to other organs in the body?
Well, first of all, we're going as fast and as safely as we can to get this treatment for humans, for people. We've tested our eye regeneration with collaborators here at Harvard on nerve crush. So if you have damaged optic nerve or potentially a spinal injury, we've shown that can our treatment can regrow the nerves and protect them from dying. We've tested it in glaucoma. And those of you who don't know, glaucoma is damage to the retina based on mostly pressure that occurs. And that works. We can restore vision in glaucoma mice. And then the third one, which I like a lot, is if you take one-year-old mice that can't see, if you give them the treatment, the gene therapy in their eye, they can see again like they were young. And that's really beautiful, a beautiful result from a student, Wan Cheng, in my lab. We expect to be doing our first clinical trial in under 2 years from now. It's not as easy as just taking something from the lab and sticking it in someone's eye. Of course, we now have to go through all of the safety studies, and even manufacturing the gene therapy is going to take about a year and probably $4 million. So, you know, we'll get there. We're going as fast as we can, as I mentioned. But what about other parts of the body? Well, we only chose the eye because we like to take on big problems. We didn't choose it because it was easy. In fact, we chose probably the hardest thing to reverse aging in, a very complex tissue, the retina. And if it works in the retina, I'd be surprised if it doesn't work in most other parts of the body. And we have injected middle-aged mice with our gene therapy and turned on the genes. And so far, they're healthy a year later. And we'll see what else we can learn. But at least it looks safe. There's all sorts of safety concerns when you mess with biology this deeply. But so far, so good.
So let's just project out, 10, 15, 20 years. Is it going to be kind of a whack-a-mole type style where, oh gosh, I'm having an issue with my liver. I go in and I get that treated, regrown, regenerated, whatever it may be. Or do you believe there's going to be an all-encompassing kind of therapy? I guess you do mention this in your book where you'll have to pick an age and go in, get a treatment, and then it'll kind of do the whole thing at once, essentially, right?
Well, we certainly have the technology now to engineer children to have these genes that we can turn on with an antibiotic. That's what we did with our mice. It's not that hard. It's just ethical, unethical, most people would say. So what's reality? Well, probably within the next 10 years, we'll have a variety of treatments for different organs where the viral gene therapy is targeted to the liver or targeted to the kidney or the eye, of course. Ultimately, where we're going with this, I don't see any reason besides a few little advances in technology and the will to do it, to be able to have a whole body treatment. And so you get this perhaps when you're 20, and you turn it on if you have an injury so you can heal. If you break your spine, you turn it on so you hopefully can walk again. And then you turn it on when you turn 50, go back another 10, 20 years, and the doctor says, come back when you've aged back to this age and we'll give you another course of antibiotics.
I cannot believe this. So what you're saying essentially is it would be living or it would be inside the host and then you would control the switch with antibiotics essentially?
Yeah, it's not that hard. My PhD student did it.
So it's engineered to turn off when it gets a course of antibiotics essentially. Is that correct?
We can do both. We can turn it on and off depending on which one we put in the animal. The one that I was referring to was if you take doxycycline, which you can get from any pharmacy for, say, Lyme disease, it's pretty harmless. If you took a course of it for 4 weeks, you would turn on these three genes that reprogram cells to be young. And then hopefully after 4 weeks, you'd see the rejuvenation. We can measure it with a blood test. We could see the clock go back, this methylation clock. And then you stop. You stop taking the doxycycline until another couple of decades later.
That's amazing. On the methylation clock that you mentioned, that's a blood test that's available today.
There's a UK company that's doing it. I don't know of anyone in the US, but I'm working with the scientist that invented the clock to be able to bring this to the public.
And that'd be great.
And so we're just working out the licensing. Yeah, a lot of people want to know how old they are. And actually, it's not just morbid trying to know what day you're going to die. It's really empowering because if you see where you're headed, you can change the trajectory of your clock by how you live. You can draw a straight line or you could try to do the kind of things that I discuss in my book and what I do in my life in an attempt to change the trajectory, bend the needle so that you can have an extra 5 or 10 years of healthy life.
Yeah, I'd love to jump into that portion of the book, the second part of the title and why we don't have to on the aging side. What are you doing and what compounds are, because I guess there's like two pieces to this. One, you're like, okay, well, we have these really promising novel technologies that 10, 15, 20 years from now are going to really drastically or dramatically change everything. But until then, there's a handful of compounds that you're interested in that you're studying that can, in theory, help bridge the gap and get us there. Do you want to go into a few of those?
Right. Well, the good news is that only 20% of our longevity is genetically predetermined and the rest is up to us because, as I mentioned, the epigenome, this analog information, you can change that. It responds to how you live, responds to adversity. And that's really the take-home message is that by sitting down and eating too much food, which is what makes us feel good, we're actually accelerating our aging clock because those epigenetic information, that epigenetic information gets lost more quickly. So there are things you can do right now in the absence of molecules. And I have a list of things that I do. The most important one, I believe, is skipping meals. A lot of people call this periodic fasting, intermittent fasting, or caloric restriction. That would be the most important one. Other things include, obvious things like exercise. There are a variety of different ways to do it. I run on a treadmill till I'm puffed, and at least for 10 minutes. And a little bit goes along the long way, actually. You don't need to be a marathon runner. And the interesting thing about what we've discovered is not that exercise makes you healthier. That's known, or that being hungry seems to make you healthier. It's actually now understanding why it works and how to mimic those effects with molecules so you can have an even greater effect than exercise and being hungry alone could give you. And that's a lot of what my research has been based on. So resveratrol was the first one, and we now have molecules that are even better. One set of molecules called NAD boosters.
Yeah, I'd love to get into NAD because I've done some experimenting with a couple of the different compounds that are out there that are said to boost NAD. I have yet to do the actual IV method. I've heard that's a little bit nauseating. But yeah, I'd love to get your take on the latest research on NAD.
Right. Well, I should mention, though, when we were talking about the clock, that there's a company, and in full disclosure, I put a small amount of money into it, so I have a conflict there. But most people are interested in how do I know what my biological age is, or at least estimate it. There's no proof. There's a company called Inside Tracker, which is here in Cambridge, that was spun out of MIT. And that's what I use. I've been using it for 11 years, so I know how to optimize my body based on this biofeedback.
Now, can I ask you a question on that? I heard you mention that in the book. And so that is essentially getting your blood drawn every X number of weeks and looking at certain biomarkers?
It is. And so they measure about 30-something. It's pretty cheap, much cheaper than you would pay if you went through a doctor. And it gives you AI derived recommendations on what to eat and how to get you back to your optimal state. Very different than if you go to your doctor. They might do a test. They don't know what to look for, if you're healthy, that is. And they call you an average person and they say, well, okay, you're not out of range for the average person. Come back when you're sick. Whereas, I think that's the wrong way to practice medicine. I think that we shouldn't just wait till people get sick. We want to know what's going on month to month and, if not year to year.
Yeah, I completely agree. So was that called Inside or Insight Tracker?
DE, insidetracker.com.
Okay.
And what's good about it also is they literally track it. And so you can see graphs of how you've been. I mean, how would anyone remember what kind of blood test results they had 10 years ago? I can look it up within 2 minutes and see, wow, I'm getting better at this. I'm getting worse at that. I better correct this. And they have data from hundreds of thousands of people and tens of thousands of customers that actually tell them what works. And I was a co-author on a paper with them that I'm pretty proud of, because we showed that giving biofeedback, as we call it, biotracking, was just as effective at lowering blood sugar as the leading diabetes drug.
That's amazing. Yeah, I can see how in aggregate you would come up with some pretty interesting insights that people could apply. I'm very lucky in that I use Peter Attia to do all this for me, but he's a little pricey for most folks. I know a lot of people have asked me, where can I go to kind of track this stuff over time? Because it is important. So this sounds like a great solution for that. How concerned are you with the genetic polymorphisms? Is that something that you look at and say, oh, I'm an NTHFR, I should be taking methylated B vitamins? Do you look into that as well?
I do. Inside Tracker actually allows you to input your genetic results, and they take that into account as well, which is increasingly important, the mix mm-hmm. of your genetics and your epigenetic output. I don't focus on my genetics because, as I said, it's not as important to my longevity as what I actually do day to day.
Right.
But it's important for sure, no question. And I live differently than most people. I have very bad genes, super high cholesterol since I was in my teens, and a history of stroke and cardiovascular disease. My grandmother had a stroke in her 30s. So I have to be very, very careful with my life.
You and me both, we're in the same camp there. My dad died of a heart attack. My grandpa passed away from a heart attack and grandma stroke. Like it's so I pay close attention to that as well.
Right. But it's really important for people to know their genetics and their blood, because otherwise you're flying blind. And as I wrote in my book, we know more about our cars and the dashboard and all the sensors on our car on a daily basis than we know about our bodies. And not just a little bit, by orders of magnitude. And no one would drive a car without a dashboard. So why do we do that for our bodies?
Yeah, I thought that was a great analogy that you used in there, because there's, you're right in that the car has so many sensors these days, almost for everything from, you know, tire pressure to you name it. And the best we have is continuous glucose monitors, right? Like there's not really anything else that's living on us all the time, outside of some sleep trackers and things like that. But it's very, very early days on that front.
It is. And I'm now testing that out just to have a glimpse into the future. And so Rhonda Patrick was the person who told me about this first. These devices, like the one that I just waved my phone at under my arm here. So my blood glucose now is 92 milligrams per deciliter. It's going up because I had a few nuts recently.
I'm 98 right now.
We all have to compete. But it's wonderful to be able to see what's going on inside your body in real time. I've never experienced this before, but the combination of having an Aura ring, which tells sleep and blood, heartbeats, movement, with things like Apple Watch, everyone's familiar with those. It's really amazing how much it focuses you on doing the right thing, because it's very easy to ignore this stuff if you don't see it.
Yeah, and the thing that I find really interesting is I have a handful of friends that we all wear the continuous glucose monitors, and we all respond so differently to the same food. I have a friend that can eat brown rice and just have very little movement in terms of glucose. I, on the other hand, unfortunately, brown rice just sends me through the roof. So it's kind of fascinating to figure out which foods are really going to spike you, and you know which ones that you can tolerate. I mean, obviously, there's the no-brainers to avoid, like anything with sugar or juice or you know super refined carbohydrates. But there's a lot of little nuance there that you wouldn't pick up unless you had a device like this.
Exactly. And we all have different microbiomes as well, and we're different ages and different sexes. And I think we have to quickly, and we are rapidly moving away from one size fits all, even when it comes to food choices. And you know, you read the literature and usually they say, oh, we took 20 people, but you might be different than all those 20. And I agree with you. I'm finding that I'm shocked by how my body responds. I didn't know actually that my blood sugar goes up just as I wake up in the morning. No surprise, actually, that I don't feel like eating breakfast. That's a sign of good health, by the way. I didn't know that either. What I've learned is that it seems weird at first. Everything, all new technology is weird. Having a supercomputer in your pocket, having a car that drives itself, it's weird. And then 2 days later, it's like, oh, how did I live without this before?
That's certainly, I think that the rate at which we're seeing new health devices, and certainly as a venture capitalist that I'm seeing them pitched at me, it's increased probably tenfold over the last 5 years. I'm seeing so many new startups that are interested in, you know, I just looked at there was a company that we funded not too long ago that does blood glucose via a patch. So it's not, you don't actually have to inject anything into you. It's just like this really thin little small, almost like Velcro like material that sticks onto you. And so that's kind of in beta right now. So it's just, there's all these devices coming online. I have a feeling the next 5 years are going to be really interesting.
Right. And not just blood glucose, of course, even the ability to measure NAD levels, which are important, detect a cancer cell years before it would show up as a tumor. These are super exciting things. And these will all combine to extend our lifespan dramatically.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about NAD. When did you first hear or get excited about some of these kind of precursors that can increase NAD?
Well, we were the first lab that showed that NAD manipulation extends lifespan. It was in 2002, 2003 in yeast cells. But it was a big deal for us because what we found was that adversity turns on NAD synthesis in the yeast cell, and you needed that for them to live longer. So in a yeast cell, what makes them live longer is you turn up the incubator temperature, you reduce the amount of sugar they eat by about fourfold, and you can also reduce the amount of amino acids that they take in. So put them on a plant-based, well, the equivalent of a plant-based rather than a meat diet. And all those make them live longer, about 30%. But no one knew why. And what we found was that it was due to the NAD levels going up and the sirtuin enzymes that we've studied for years being more active, the one that resveratrol activates. And that was a real shocker because no one thought that these treatments were all working through the same mechanism and the same gene, but they actually were. Fast forward a few years, we started putting on cells these NAD precursors to boost NAD levels rather than genetically. We started to do pharmacological treatment for obvious reasons, because we can't easily genetically manipulate ourselves yet. And so we started feeding yeast cells, NMN and NR. Other labs did too. I'm not taking full credit for any of this. But there was a band of about five of us who were trying this. And we saw that there was lifespan extension in yeast, and then in worms, then in flies, and then in mice, a little bit. I don't think we've really been able to show dramatically yet that they extend lifespan in mice. But what we have shown, many of us around the world, is that these precursors reduce aspects of aging, reverse aspects of aging. In my lab, we published a paper last year. For example, if we put NMN, which is one of the immediate precursor of NAD in the body, we just put that in, sprinkled it in the water of the mice. 4 weeks later, they could run like they were young again. So we're taking mice that are 2 years old and making them about a three-month-old. And they ran 50%, in some cases, twofold further on a treadmill. And we figured out that was through this sirtuin gene that we first showed in yeast was important. And then finally, what's important is we figured out also why those mice could run further. And that was because they were basically responding as though they'd been exercising, but they hadn't. This is an exercise mimetic that increases blood flow in muscles, builds new capillaries in the system, in both the muscle and in the brain, we now know, which is a great thing, right, for the elderly who cannot run marathons, but you want to simulate and stimulate those same pathways that exercise and would give you, including those health benefits.
Why haven't we seen that pan out in humans? Like humans, if you feed them NMN right now, I haven't heard of any studies that have shown increased athletic performance based on that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, right now, there are a number of studies ongoing, and one that was done by Doug Seals, University of Colorado, I believe, was negative. Nicotinamide riboside, a different molecule we haven't studied much in my lab, did not increase endurance. So yeah, we have a one strike against it. On the other hand, we work with NMN, which in our hands works better in mice for endurance than NR, for reasons we can just speculate. And we're doing those studies. So we'll know by next year if we improve blood flow in people using NMN at doses that we've shown are both safe and effective at raising NAD in the body, in the blood system.
What can people expect? I know that I've heard a handful of friends that have been on these compounds for a while now, and they've said, I've heard everything from my skin gets better to my gray hair is now turning brown again. Are either of those claims true at all?
I don't know. We wouldn't know unless there was a placebo.
Right. Have you heard of any kind of... Yeah. What have you heard in terms of people in your lab that are does anything stand out, I guess, is what I'm getting to, is if you take this compound for, a few months, is there any type of material difference? I know it's subjective, but do people tend to report anything different?
Well, I hear a lot of anecdotes every day, and it's consistent. People say more energy, more alertness, better memory. A lot of people say that that their time of doing certain sports has improved. Some people know their bodies very well, and they know that if they shave a minute off, half a marathon, that's significant. And there are people that tell me that happened, and bike riders as well. But I'm a scientist, so I can't conclude anything. But it all points in the same direction as what we see in the mice.
And how are we measuring this in, because I know that there's been some controversy over, is it actually getting to the place that it needs to get to in the body? Where do we stand on it actually escaping and getting throughout the body versus it just sitting in, it's the liver that it hangs out in, or is that right?
That's what people are saying in mice. Now, there's a few things to consider when you're looking at these debates online and even in the scientific literature. Not all scientists are unbiased. It's the main reason that I don't get involved with supplement companies. I don't have a favorite. I've just, made the best molecule win. And that said, we have better molecules than any of them that are currently out there that we're testing right now, so 5 times better. So, you know, hopefully one of those is going to work. So yeah, beware that people who say, you know, NR is better than NMN or vice versa, they really do have some bias, I think. Also, the mouse results are mouse results, right? We still need to show this in humans. It's very hard to take a liver biopsy of a human. You can do a muscle biopsy, which we're planning on doing in our studies. But here's the bottom line. I'm not going to debate which is better molecule. I'm just going to test it. And what I can tell you for sure, 100%, bet my life on it because I've seen it. You can swallow a pill of NMN and you can raise NAD levels in the blood of a human very well. And if you take it for a few days, it's even better than taking it once. Now, that's not up for debate. You know, whether it hangs out in the liver or whether it goes through this or that transporter or is metabolized by the gut, that's great. You know, let's fight about that. But it doesn't change the fact that it works.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of safety, that is something that I've always been a little bit kind of let's wait and see. What are your thoughts? You know, if this is really truly kind of helping us out and getting into the cells, like, is there any danger around it accelerating things like cancer? Like, if you already have cancer and you start taking NMN, is there any concern there? And also, somewhat related, you know, I heard a while back that, for example, Peter Attia will tell you not to take high dose B vitamins, especially people that have smoked in the past, because there was that link between high dose B vitamins and lung cancer. And so I'm curious, this being, you know, a type or a somewhat of a type of form of B vitamin, do you have similar concerns?
Yes. We don't know the long-term effects of raising NAD levels. We do know that having high NAD levels when you're young doesn't hurt you. As far as we know, we don't think that when you're young, you're predisposed to cancer. It's when you get old and you have lower NAD levels. So that correlation is there. But there's also the concern that, as I mentioned before, that NMN boosts blood flow. And if you have a tumor that's growing, tumors like blood flow typically, mm-hmm. and we call it angiogenesis. Now, there's a couple of points I want to make. One is that we've tested NMN in mouse cancer models already. We'll be publishing it, but it's not yet out there. We tested it in a lung cancer model and a liver cancer model. And in both cases, there was no exacerbation of the tumor. And in the case of lung cancer, actually, NMN was slowing the tumor down in combination and independently of chemotherapy. So that's all good. I mean, hopefully people who know me now know that I want to be the first person to know if there's a problem. Mm-hmm. My family's taking this stuff. And if there is a problem, I want to know. So I'm testing this all the time. And, you know, the moment that I tell the world I've stopped taking it, then you know I've seen something that worries me. Okay,
right.
That's how to read it. And I see a lot of data before the world sees it. And for instance, what I just mentioned. But I also am able to read very deeply and interpret scientific findings. And the scientific finding that is typically put forth by people as evidence that NAD might cause a brain tumor is a study from Washington University in St. Louis. And what they showed in that paper, and I read this routinely just to remind myself, they knocked out the major gene that controls NAD biosynthesis. And what it did was it slowed the cancers down and slowed the cancer cells' growth. So what that tells us is that cancer cells need NAD to grow. That's not a surprise because all cells need NAD to grow, that NAD is required for metabolic reactions and growth, okay? But what that doesn't mean is if you put NAD levels up to the levels of a young person, that you'll cause brain cancer. That's a total misrepresentation of that finding. And where it started was the press office at WashU, I guess, thought it would attract more attention by putting a headline that these scientists had shown that NAD boosting might cause cancer, which is not what the scientists were saying in that paper.
That's too bad when press teams get a hold of papers and tend to write these big, bold, attention-grabbing headlines, right? It's brutal.
Yeah. But that said, if I had a tumor or I had a predisposition to cancer in my family, I wouldn't risk it. I don't think we know enough. And, you know, that's the big question mark about this. We have probably, how many people, Kevin, do you think are taking NAD boosters in the country? Must be a lot, right?
A few hundred thousand, I would think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So far nobody's died. So that's good. I haven't heard of anybody developing cancer as a result, but it's hard to know. But that's the worry, that we'll learn 5 years from now that it is unsafe. But so far, we don't think so. The good news is, scientifically, it doesn't, to me, there's no evidence that it does. And also, it's a natural molecule. And thirdly, the young people have high levels anyway. And if you run and if you fast, you have high levels. And those things don't cause cancer. And if anything, they prevent it.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is this idea of kind of pulsing different compounds, where you don't take something every single day, but you do it on and off. Do you do that with NAD, or is that something that you take daily?
Well, I take NMN most days, and I'll tell you why. It's because usually I've only slept a small amount. I've worked till 1 a.m., and then I wake up and I need a boost, and I find for myself that it'll, you know, give my brain a kickstart. It's great with a cup of coffee. So I do that. But, you know, occasionally I don't mind skipping it. I'm not worried if I don't take it, because I know that it's just like exercise. You don't need to probably do it every day. And occasionally I don't take metformin either. If I've gone to the gym and I want my muscles to rebuild, I think the evidence is that it's better not to take metformin. And pulsing is important. Intermittent fasting is pulsing, right? You're not always mm-hmm. hungry. You can be, but you don't need to be. And the same for hot and cold shocking. Some evidence that works. You don't want to always be cold. And you don't always want to be in a sauna. You just want to get your body in a state of perceived adversity. And that what you need to do is not be a frog in a pot of boiling water. You want to drop the frog in and scare your body that something's going wrong, but then step back from it so it can adjust.
Yeah, I'm doing the sauna 5 days a week now. And then I do, every winter, starting at November 1st, I do the Wim Hof method for 8 weeks, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with Wim Hof, but it is works you up to a 15-minute ice bath by the time you're done with the course. It's pretty intense, but it feels amazing.
Does it? Yeah, that sounds pretty brutal. I haven't done that. I find it bad enough just dunking into a 4-degree Celsius water bath after the sauna. But yeah, I agree. We feel great after we do this. The body needs to be jolted once in a while. We call this hormesis. Mm-hmm. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. What doesn't kill you will make you live longer. And we showed this, as I mentioned, very clearly in yeast cells. And now we know it's true for our bodies as well.
Do you think that a lot of potential future research should be focused around these different like hormetic plants that you hear of, like these plants that cause this type of state to occur?
I do, but it goes against traditional medicine. So pharmaceutical companies, poo-poo natural molecules, because typically they hit more than one enzyme. But that's the beauty of them. Resveratrol interacts with probably a dozen different enzymes that each one has a beneficial effect, we think, on longevity. But they call that a dirty molecule because it's harder to study, it's harder to make it safe if it's a synthetic version. Mm-hmm. But I think that natural molecules are great. You know, resveratrol is just one of dozens that we've studied in my lab. Fisetin is one that activates SIRT1 and seems to antagonize the zombie cells, the senescent cells in the body. There's a whole bunch. Anyway, we could go into too many of those. Some of them are listed in the book. But yeah, what's interesting is what's called xenohormesis. I've told you what hormesis is. Mm-hmm. Xeno, X-E-N-O, is just coming in from the outside from another species. So put together, xenohormesis is just a terrible word that we came up with that describes the idea that when plants are stressed, they make beneficial molecules to turn on their own defenses. Mm-hmm. But we've evolved to sense adversity in our food supply, because that's a good sign that things are going to hit the fan pretty soon. If your crop or your berry that you eat is about to all die off, your body wants to know about that. And the best way to know that, especially if you're not a conscious being, and most of the time we haven't been conscious in our evolution, you take in those chemicals and your body hunkers down and goes into survival mode.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's like it is a really early warning system.
Yeah, and there are a couple of corollaries to that. It means that we could find a lot of drugs in stressed plants. And it also means we should eat food that is stressed out before it's picked. And grapes are a good example of that. But colored foods typically have a lot of these, you know, hermetic molecules as well.
Yeah, there was a really interesting documentary that I saw recently that talked about how mycelium, the connection of mycelium between trees at the root level is they're able to transport information from tree to tree, showing that there is potentially some type of stressor coming. So some type of, whether a tree is diseased or undergoing stress, it can then communicate that out to the younger trees, which is just fascinating that that actually happens.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'm curious on one topic that I haven't heard you talk about on other podcasts, and just to get your take on that is brain health. You know, it's such a really tricky, challenging area that I feel like has very little progress. What's your take on how to maintain a healthy brain, and do you think there's anything on the horizon for, you know, some of these really debilitating type of dementias and things that seems like everyone's coming down with?
Yeah, and actually it's the worst situation where we've spent most of modern medicine treating parts of the body that are not the brain and being quite successful. And now we're left with, no surprise, majority of people whose brain is the problem, even though their hearts continue to beat. That's the worst nightmare of medicine. And, you know, it comes from what I call in the book whack-a-mole medicine approach. What we take as an approach is to keep the whole body healthy. We're activating the body's natural defenses, and that works in every cell. These sirtuin defenses that we work on, every cell has those, and NAD is in every cell as well. Another thing that's worth pointing out is that the brain actually is a very hard organ to model in a mouse. One of the problems is that our brain is very different than a mouse, but the other thing that's different is that we live 80, 90 years, and a mouse only lives 2 years. And if we go back to that idea about the information theory of aging, mice don't get a lot of those scratches that we do on their DVD. And what we've been able to do in my lab, in an attempt to make a mouse more like a human, is to really scratch up the DVD of the brain of a mouse, and including the whole body. And when we do that, by cutting the chromosome, making it heal, basically unwrap the present, repackage it. We do that for 3 weeks in the mouse, and it is accelerated in its aging by 50%. We can do it even more. We can go ahead fivefold and make a mouse that's more like an old human, and they get dementia and their brains behave more like an old human. And what I'm proposing is that if we can use mice like these to find drugs that will help human brains, we'd be a lot more successful than trying to understand a process in a mouse that's only 1 or 2 years old.
Hmm. So we're basically starting from scratch then, because this is a relatively new way of doing things.
Right. These mice, we call them the nice mice. They're not even published yet. Though if readers are really curious, they can go to the journal Cell, C-E-L-L. And just a few days ago, they were put online on what's called the Sneak Peeks website. So you can download it. You can have a look what these mice look like. There's pictures of them and how they behave. And they don't just look old. They are literally old. We've given them aging. And if we measure their age by the clock, they are 50% older. And that's why I'm fairly convinced that the information theory of aging is correct.
And do you have, in terms of things that you do personally, when I was reading your book, I was reading all the different things in terms of, you know, like sauna usage, and you talk about metformin, and I'm on the train in terms of pretty much everything that you had gone through, both in terms of compound and physical activity. Is there anything else that you're seeing on the horizon in terms of brain health that you or your colleagues are starting to embrace at all?
There's one that's near and dear to my heart, which is we just showed with Zoltan Umvari's lab that NMN increases the blood flow in an old brain. And vascular dementia is one of the worst diseases, very common. Anyone who's had grandparents who start to lose their memory, a lot of it's due to just basically vascular disease in the brain. And there's nothing you can do to reverse that, whereas we found that by keeping NAD levels high in the lining of those blood vessels in muscle and in the brain, we can actually restore the blood flow. And we think that that'll have a big impact on elderly people's brains if we can get a drug on the market. And perhaps that could be something that could be studied, is to take vascular dementia patients, put them on NMN for a few months and see if their brains become more active. And so anyone who's interested in doing that trial, I'd be happy to help.
For people that are interested in this book, what do you hope that they will get out of it? Like if they read through, other than just, you know, I personally found your kind of regimen of things that you do really fascinating and where the science is going, but who did you write this book for and what will they get out of it?
Well, I wrote it for everybody. Everybody that really wants to understand why living a certain way is good for them. And also as a guide, how to make the right decisions in life. And it goes not just to page 302, where I list all of the things that my father does and I do and my wife does. You know, feel free to skip to the end of the book if you're curious. But before you get there, what you'll be taken on is a journey through the beginning of life to human history in attempts to slow down aging that will guide us towards the future. So and also that there's anecdotes about what has happened to my family and what's happened to others who have changed their lifestyle the way we're talking about. And also what's important really is for readers to understand that aging is not just a given. It's not something that we have to just accept. I call aging a disease, and that disease is treatable. And I believe I make a strong argument that we've been ignoring the biggest cause of death for the last few hundred years, and it's time to focus in on it. And it should be empowering. The instructions to live your life daily with different approaches. Kevin, sounds like you're doing a very good job daily to live longer. But also to realize that we could easily, each one of us, live another 10 years if we just adopt these changes, relatively simple changes, whether it's skipping breakfast and having a late lunch or getting out of breath on a treadmill or a Stairmaster every few days. These are not big changes. They make you feel great. And I certainly haven't regretted doing that for the last 20 years. My father, who's now 80, is one of the happiest guys you'll ever meet, because 10 years ago he thought his life was over. And now at 80, he started a new career, is traveling the world, climbing mountains with his grandkids. And that's what I want everyone to know, is that it's in their own hands. We don't just have to live with what we thought was inevitable.
Yeah, I thought that it was a really interesting story when you talked about your father and when he started adopting some of these different changes, was outperforming his friends, right? Like all of a sudden had this new surge of energy, newfound energy, which sounded great.
He did. So I'm very proud of him. And it's not a clinical trial, but he's a beacon of hope. He's a symbol of what life could be like for millions of people. So at 80, where most of his friends have now died, he feels like he's 20. He's got no diseases, no aches and pains, no indication of disease on the way, and just loving life and looking forward to the future. Whereas 10 years ago, he was not looking forward to what was coming, because he had seen what had happened to all of his ancestors and his mother, who spent the last 10 years not even going out of the home. And, you know, we won't know ever if it's because of the lifestyle or the molecules or both. But what I can tell you is something's going on, because no one in our family is 80 and healthy except for him.
Wow, that's crazy. Because you said there had been heart disease in your family. Did he have any of those heart disease issues or?
Yeah. I mean, he had high blood sugar. He became diabetic. He was high cholesterol, had a typical male heart attack or a stroke like his mother had. Instead, he grabbed life by the horns. He started doing exercise. He's fasting. He's taking NMN, metformin, and resveratrol, the same combination as my family and I. And this, you know, he's a different guy emotionally, mentally, physically. He can see well, hear well, think well. You know, again, if any of my colleagues are listening, I'm not saying that I know why this is occurring, but you got to admit, there aren't that many 80-year-olds who are, you know, feeling like they did when they were 20 or 30. And in fact, he's stronger than I am. And I go to the gym and I'm only 50 and I regard myself as in pretty good shape. But we did a head to head at the gym and he kicked my butt.
That's amazing. At 80. You're not doing any rapamycin or anything like that. You're not a crazy Atiya like on that front, are you?
I'm not. I'm very happy with my biological age and my physical fitness. So I'm not going that far. I'm adding things, you know, one by one every few years. Maybe I'll try it when there's a bit more evidence. And honestly, it's not that hard to get either. Not that easy to get. Peter can just order it up. He's a doctor. But on the other hand, rapamycin is still, it's got some side effects. We don't know the long-term effects of even small doses. So that's one that I haven't been using or trying. You know, on the other hand, I don't know if people know what I look like, but I've got most of my hair. I've got no gray hair. I've got very few wrinkles. So something seems to be going okay. Doesn't mean I won't drop dead from a heart attack tomorrow. But, you know, as far as I can tell, I'm doing okay for my age.
A little surprised to see you on the metformin train. Is any of that like latest research around it kind of blunting some of the effects of anaerobic exercise? Is any of that concerning to you?
No, because the bottom line is that by looking at 100,000 plus patients with diabetes, they were protected against cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, and frailty. And that data doesn't lie. That's a very strong indicator that this is an anti-aging molecule. And, you know, so what if it stops muscles being bigger? They're actually just as strong if you look at the data carefully. You know, you can adapt, which I have. I take metformin less when I'm exercising. But I think in the long run, it's the best molecule we have right now based on all of the data that points to it protecting from most major diseases.
And it's really inexpensive too, which is wonderful. You're taking a gram a day, is that right?
Right. Well, not every day, as I said, but typically I'd take 500 milligrams in the morning with a spoonful of yogurt and resveratrol, and then I'll take it again at night if I feel like I can handle it. I'm one of those people that has stomach upset when I eat metformin pills.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp. I've done the extended release, and that seems to help a bit. I don't know if you've messed around with the XR version of that.
I'd like to. I get my metformin from Thailand, and they just have the cheap and nasty stuff. So that's what I've got. But yeah, I think that's a good solution. And also working up to a higher dose from a small dose seems to work for some people, I've heard. Or having it with some food or a glass of milk is also helpful. But, you know, I think that metformin is a remarkable drug. It's only called a drug because the FDA calls it a drug. It's an over-the-counter drug in most of the rest of the world, besides Europe and America and Australia. And the World Health Organization lists it as an essential medicine for humanity. Right? This is a really big deal. And it's only a slight chemical modification from a natural molecule that's found in French lilac plants.
Right.
So, you know, it sounds scary when you say, ooh, David's taking a drug. But big deal. You know, it's a molecule. And it's been proven to be much safer than probably a lot of molecules that you can get on Amazon. So, you know, don't be fooled. Just because a doctor is needed in this country, it doesn't put it in any special, you know, magical category.
Do you think in your research, is there a certain minimum effective dose you aim for a gram. I'm doing 1,500 milligrams a day. Why did you choose a gram versus 1,500?
Well, like you, I know a lot of very smart people, and I asked their opinion, and I'm going on the recommendations of Nir Barzilai, who's probably the world's expert on this. And I send him my blood glucose charts too, and he tells me how I'm doing. So, you know, I'm fortunate to be able to get the advice of these folks and pass it on to everyone else.
Yeah. One last question about resveratrol. I noticed you're doing a gram a day. Most of the resveratrol that I see, you know, online that for purchase is quite a bit less in terms of, you know, 100, 150 milligrams. Why go up that high? What data are you looking at?
Well, it's a synthesis of what I know about the human trials, some of which nobody, or very few people have access to. It's also based on years and years of research. What is it now? 14 years of research in animals on what dose works and what dose is toxic. And the minimum dose that we would see if you convert it from the animal studies, it would be 250 milligrams. Mm-hmm. So why do I go up to a gram? Well, I don't see any toxicity. So, you know, the worst is that it's being peed out. I don't think that I'm doing any harm. I do monitor myself. I'm very careful to make sure that I'm not hurting my liver. And if anything, my liver enzymes are extremely low. So, you know, I'm unusual in that everyone who listens to this and says, oh, I'll just take a gram of this or a gram of that, be cognizant of the fact that I do this with myself as a scientist. I want to learn and I'm monitoring myself. So if something did go wrong, I'd be the first to know about it, right? It doesn't, you know, I'm not suggesting anyone just go off and start taking grams of molecules without monitoring and seeing if it works for them.
Sure.
And there are ways of doing that. But yeah, a gram, you know, I find that a gram keeps my cardiovascular system apparently quite healthy. I monitor my cardiovascular system very well. Actually, I had an MRI done, a 3D movie made of my heart. I was very curious. I asked a friend of mine to put me in a machine, and he told me that my heart was perfectly young. And this was just a couple of years ago when I was 48. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be hurting me. And if anything, I'm just wasting a bit of money.
Yeah. Well, last question for you, and possibly the most important one. I have a miniature Labradoodle that is 9 years old. And I know in your book, you had mentioned that you give is it dog or dogs? NMN.
Dogs.
Curious about that. What can I do to extend the life of my beloved little miniature Labradoodle?
Again, people are probably saying, well, how can you give it to your dog? You haven't tested it on animals. Well, we've actually tested molecules on dogs. So we have some idea. And you know, often people forget that I have a front row seat on data. So we know so far that it's probably safe in dogs as well as in mice, and so far in humans. We're not experimenting on our dogs by any means. But we do love them just like any member of the family.
Sure.
And we do want them to live longer. So my wife is a dog person. She runs a therapy dog organization in New England, takes dogs and their owners to hospitals and nursing homes. So she knows dogs well. She's the one that feeds them. They get a weight-dependent dose of NMN in a little treat, probably once every 2 days, not every day. One of the main reasons that our 8-year-old dog doesn't get it every day is it becomes too hyper.
Oh, crazy.
You don't want a hyper dog at a nursing home.
That's fascinating, though, that you can see the results like that.
Well, again, it's not a we don't do placebos in our home.
Sure.
But my wife knows this dog like it's her own body, and she will swear. By the way, she's also a scientist trained at MIT, so she does. She's quite an astute scientist herself. So when she says it's right, it's probably right. She's also German, and Germans don't lie.
Is there anywhere that it's published, the grams to kilogram kind of weight? Like, would you have any sense of what a dog cocktail would look like, or like what you would actually dose a dog?
I'd have to check. So please, nobody go exactly on this number, but it's about 100 milligrams, something like that. I can post that. You know, I have a newsletter, so if the listeners would like to sign up for that, that's a good source of information.
Yeah, that was my next question. Where can people keep up to date with all of your latest and greatest research?
So the newsletter, you can sign up, and it's called lifespanbook.com. And you just put your email, you'll get that every month. And I try to make that as interesting and as useful as possible. And often it's based on questions from people who are in touch with me through social media. So the way to get in touch with me through social media is I'm on Twitter at David A. Sinclair, and Instagram is David Sinclair, PhD. And so I'm very active on that. I spend about an hour a night talking with people on social media. And if I don't get back to you immediately, it's just because I've been swamped.
That was great. Thank you, David, so much for being on the show. I highly recommend everyone pick up a copy of the book. I ended up getting it on Audible, actually, and when I was sitting in the sauna, just jamming through it there. Really, the thing I really like about the book is you paint this picture of the future and how technology is going to intertwine with our lives. And being a technologist and someone that's kind of like geeky and into sci-fi, you can see that this stuff is coming at a very fast pace and it's going to be here before we know it. And you kind of paint this amazing roadmap of what's to come over the next couple of decades, which I thought was really fascinating.
Thanks. And you and I are trying to make that future come as fast as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you have any startups you want me to look at, I'd love to talk to them about funding, especially if they're into any of the things that you mentioned in the book, because I believe it's inevitable. Like this is all coming. So really cool stuff.
All right. That's it for this show. I hope you enjoyed it. But before I let you go, I want to tell you a little bit more about the Jordan Harbinger podcast.
All right. I wanted to take this quick break to talk about another one of my favorite podcasts, the Jordan Harbinger Show. Jordan, you're here with me. Thank you for being on for this quick little segment.
For sure.
I wanted to plug your show again because I think you have an awesome show where you go really deep with your guests, so deep so that you actually create these worksheets that have practical advice of every guest that you do, which is awesome. And I know you just had Dennis Rodman on. What was that like?
So Dennis Rodman, that guy's a freaking phenomenon, as you might imagine. I mean, this was an interview where I walked in and he's doing an IV drip, which is kind of your department, right? He's doing an IV drip during the show. And I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm getting some vitamins and some NAD. You know, he's abused his body in a lot of ways. Yeah. So
that NAD IV drip can make you really nauseous. Was he nauseous at all?
So he was very strange. And my crew was like, is he okay? And I was like, yeah, I don't know what. So I go, what's in the drip? And he goes, NAD. And I'm feeling a little effed up right now. And I was like, that explains a lot. Because he was pretty standoffish. And then after a while, we warmed him up. And he was starting to like yell at Donald Trump a little to let me back into North Korea. And then because I was actually in North Korea at the same time as Dennis Rodman. So we riffed on that for a while. I actually saw him there, which is crazy. And then he's talking about a little bit of biohacking stuff that he's doing. He's talking about how he was such a character back in the day and what was going through his head. I mean, this is a guy who has some, to put it politely, some mental health stuff going on, but is a fascinating, fascinating guy and is actually really, really smart in his, I'll say in his own way. He's a very smart and very talented guy. I mean, he's one of the guys, the best players to ever play the game. He's in the Hall of Fame, and yet he didn't even really play basketball until college, which is insane. So
that's crazy.
It was a literally insane interview for many different reasons. And that was one of my most memorable just because, I mean, who does an IV drip during a show, for God's sake?
That's nuts. Well, I got to go check out that episode, and you can get a link to this episode in the show notes and then also in the description here. But where can people find you online if they want to go and subscribe to the show?
Sure. The Jordan Harbinger Show, just like it sounds. Jordan and Harbinger are luckily both words in the dictionary. And you can find me in any podcast app or at jordanharbinger.com.
Awesome. One of my favorites. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
All right. That's it for this show. Please do me one last favor and head on over to where you found this podcast, normally in your favorite podcasting app or on the Apple Store, and rate us 5 stars. That would really help us get recommended to more people and have better guests on the show. Take care.